And welcome back to Speak Up Las Cruces with Walter Rubel and Peter Goodman co-hosting today. And our guest for the next half hour plus is Dave Dubois, a frequent guest on the show whenever his schedule permits. He is the state climatologist and an NMSU professor and a friend. And the particular occasion, there's a lot to talk about beyond this, but the particular occasion we want to make sure everybody's aware of is Earth Day. And what are we going to do here to celebrate it?
Well, we have a special event planned for this coming Saturday. That's April 18th at Young Park. And so we've got a mixture of activities starting at 3 p.m. at Young Park. 3 to 6, we have informational tables, interactive activities, various organizations from around the area, NMSU, and, you know, talking about anything to do with environment, the earth. And then after that, so it's starting at 6 p.m., we've got some local bands to come to play for us.
And we'll get to those are in a moment. But in the early part, so there'll be booths people can visit and talk to different organizations and, you know, get whatever. Are there also going to be speeches or not anything general like that? Or?
Well, we'll see. I think it's mainly going to be, there may be, you know, talking to folks. I'll be there representing NMSU, the New Mexico Climate Center. There'll be, and then we're going to also have a recruitment for COCORAZ as well. But yeah, there'll be opportunities to ask lots of questions to people about the earth and how to conserve and, you know, talk about it.
Tell people what COCORAZ is. I know because of my wife.
But. Yeah. Yeah, thanks for asking. Yo, so COCORAZ is a citizen science program, and it's an acronym. It's Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Program. And it's basically we measure rain, hail, and snow all over. Any ages can help us.
Yeah, so for example, we got a rain gauge out back of the house, and if it actually rains, which ain't every day here, communicate somehow to you folks, probably online, and says, you know, here's how much we got. And then she can look and see how much people got in La Mesa or Hatch or wherever. And it's kind of fun, and it's a contribution to kind of general knowledge. Who are you probably know as well as I, Walt, or as well as Dave, but who are the bands that are going to be playing?
Okay, there's a list here, as I pulled up. One of them is Frontera Boogaloo. And that's one of the bands. And then Era Snow, a solo singer-songwriter, she'll be there. And Desert Roots, it's a reggae and dub band. Mm-hmm. And then Mule Tones, it's a sort of a classic American folk. And they have performed at the farmer's market. So if you go to the farmer's market, it's
Every Saturday. Yeah. But Walt, we're going to do a remote from there, right?
We are going to do a remote. That's going to be from 7 to 9, I'm sorry. 7 to 9, that's correct.
The music part.
Yeah, the music part. Alex Brinkley and Casey Chacon from Local Vibes Live will be out there broadcasting a lot of the music. We'll have a little bit short interviews about Earth Day that we can interject during the program.
Good, good.
And, that'll be from 7 to 9 this Saturday. After our from 11 till 12 at the farmer's market. So we have two live remotes going this Saturday.
There's a lot to talk about, drought, El Nino, but one of the subjects we've often talked about, and it's a real moving target over the years, is climate change or global weirdness or whatever you want to call it, is an urgent problem. And, you know, that science knows that. Most people know it. Most countries know it. And you, of course, you bring a particular perspective as both a Christian and, you know, mm-hmm. Westerner and a scientist. But some time ago, you know, we'd talk about the fact that most people didn't believe in it, or a lot of people that you interacted with. So I guess my awkward question is, how has that changed? It's, you know, has that debate, is that debate mostly over among most people, farmers and others, ranchers, or not. And at the same time, how weird it is it to be one of the only countries that it, you know, where the government has its head in the sand?
Well, from my perspective, our viewpoints don't change in the science. It's the same.
Sure.
And a lot of folks who were, who we talked to in the past, you know, they're still on board with, you know, it's us, you know, we need to do action. And however, you know, there's, as we all know, the administration has, you know, tried to push us in terms of thinking otherwise.
What about the popular view? I mean, it used to be a lot of ranchers were nonsense or whatever. God will take care of it. And is that no longer so for the most part, or is it still?
They're still there. They're still there. And I have different ways of communicating to folks who aren't on board with the causes. Most folks agree that it's happening. You said, we've seen temperatures rise, you know, folks, especially our ranchers, they know, you know, they've seen the temperatures change and they know the climate is changing, but it's more of why and then how do we, is there a need to address it? Those are the bottom line questions that we really have to kind of dig in and kind of explain ourselves and explain the science. And there's lots of ways to do that without kind of alienating people, you know, saying, oh, it's this, and just kind of hit them on the head with a bunch of, you know, climate science, right. You know, and I don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did it a few times and when I first started as a state climatologist, and it really didn't work. So kind of changing gears and saying, so how do I actually do this? And thinking about what people care about. And then starting off with weather, you know, long-term weather, that's the new word for climate change these days. And we have to adjust to that. And that's fine. I mean, call it what we want, but it's still there.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter what you call it. It's still a train moving.
Who made it? Who made that change?
Well, we have to adjust, you know, with federal grants, which is a kind of a fun topic, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we have climate change in our name of our grants. And it's like a big target for, that needs to go. So, you know, how do
long-term
we adjust?
Long-term weather patterns.
Yeah, so how do
all
we,
the Doge brothers are going through and looking for keywords. And
Yeah, exactly. So how do we do a global search and replace on these words in our documents? And we're kind of rolling with it, you know, but we get the same work done. You know, how do we adapt to a changing climate? You know?
Well, it's one of those things because of what Dale and other people are doing, the numbers are there.
Right.
So you can't argue it is what it is. It seems to me like a lot of people have gone from denial to hopelessness. Okay, it's here. We just have to live with it, you know.
I do get a sense of that a lot. So it's much bigger than I can kind of grasp or even address. Even the U.S., you know, we're still, you know, we're a significant contributor to, you know, the greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change, but we're not the only one out there. And there's other countries or, you know, there are big, you know, in terms of economic, you know, producing, you know, burning coal and natural gas at large amounts. And so we're in the group there, you know, we used to be the largest contributor, but we're no longer, but it's sort of like that. It's sort of, we need to do what we need to do. You know, we know the science, and we need to be a leader in leading the rest of the world. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I know you're a climatologist, a scientist, and not an economist and an oil guy, but it seems pretty clear that we're about ready to experience the biggest disruption in the oil market, at least since the Arab oil embargo of the 1970s. Does that force people to start looking for alternatives, do you think?
Well, I mean, my work truck, you know, is a F-150 and good truck, but it, you know, looking at the dollars when I go fill it up,
exactly.
You know, especially if that was my personal vehicle, you know, driving, you know, I put, you know, $90 of gas in, you know, filling it up. And unless you're rich, yeah, that's a lot of money for, you know, just to drive, you know, for a few hours. You know, I can drive to Albuquerque a little more with that tank, and that's it.
Right.
And we have
the best of it. For us, prices are going up. For other parts of the world, it's just not going to be available, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the people who are developing the renewables, I think they're willing to keep going, unfortunately we're relying on, you know, subsidies and things like that, that is right. Changing, you know, over, you know, but due to politics.
Right, right. One of the big things for the state is that we have passed this, you know, I think it's 2045, where all of the power plants are supposed to be non-polluting. A couple of questions. First of all, is that a realistic goal, and are they making progress towards it?
Well, that's a good question. I think I've talked to, you know, folks at New Mexico Environment Department, and they have a plan. So I think we need to listen to them. And so how do we actually do this? You know, people focusing on that, and how do we, you know, get more renewables? I think that's the goal. I think it'd be great. You know, we need to diversify our fuels, and renewables are great in New Mexico, right?
Right.
You know, we've got lots of sun and we need to use it.
And I know we've got a caller. My second part is, how much does Project Jupiter and them getting the exemption undermine what state is trying to do?
Yeah, that's a big one, because, you know, they have to produce their own power on site. So they call it microgrid.
Yeah,
but
right.
It's basically
nothing micro about it.
A bunch of power plants, and they're tagged together to power this data center. And it's like the same thing all over the world.
We have a caller. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to ask Dr. Dubois if he believes the war in Iran and all the global destruction and the burning fossil fuels in the air will be reaching New Mexico anytime soon based on this ecological disaster happening.
Well, thanks for that question. It is a good question. You know, with greenhouse gases specifically, I think you're talking, I mean, there's disruptions in, you know, emissions of air pollution as well as greenhouse gases, you know, like CO2, methane are the two most contributors to climate change. Having emissions of those in areas around the world, it contributes to the overall burden. You know, the greenhouse gases are mainly well mixed. They mix through the atmosphere, and they can do kind of local hotspots in terms of warming, but it's mainly it's the overall general concentrations of those gases globally that really makes a difference. Whereas if you're looking at the localized, the air pollution part of it, that's more of the human health and that can give you an immediate impact. Whereas the greenhouse gases that, you know, we're basically locked in from emissions from like 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of, it's that long-term baseline. And then even if we stopped everything right now, we would still have the gases, you know, the greenhouse gases at our concentrations for decades. So it's more of, you know, it makes a difference, of course, but in terms of the short term, it's not as much impact for short term versus the long term. With the exception of aerosols, there's been a lot of studies about how aerosols are air pollution. If we start cleaning the air pollution, which basically is the haze, that actually allows more solar radiation to reach the ground, and it was actually causing more heating. And if we clean it up, we allow more heat of the solar radiation to come in. Whereas in the past, that air pollution was kind of bouncing a lot of the solar radiation off, and it was actually creating a cooling effect. And then it's kind of a really weird thing. If we clean up, we actually make it worse.
Yeah, completely counterintuitive.
Yeah, so it's that there's a lot of, it's a complex function of all the different things, like worldwide, and sometimes it's in little areas like Southeast Asia.
For real quickly, for the sake of argument, let's say that Donald Trump went through with his threat to bomb the oil fields. Iran retaliated by bombing oil fields in Kuwait and Oman. And what would the result of that be
terms of those two different factors? The global warming, you know, the greenhouse gases, whereas air pollution, the most immediate would be air pollution. So you're burning gases, and we've seen that before. When we were in Kuwait, you know, it was,
right.
massive black plumes of smoke.
That's
And that has caused a lot of, you know, respiratory problems local, mm-hmm. you know, so it's affecting human health in a whole region. So, you know, in terms of 100 kilometers, you know, affecting. And then the fact that it's black absorbs solar radiation. So that's a, you know, as part of a climate changing factor is that black, it's called black soot or black carbon. And so that right. can actually warm, if it's distributed over, you know, a large area, like a whole continent, right. that can actually do some warming in that area.
I think we have another caller. Is that? So, are you there yet, caller?
Yes, yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, I would like Dr. Dubois to confirm this first before he answers my question, but I believe that our air pollution is really bad, and we live in this beautiful place, in this beautiful valley, and it just seems really sad and shocking, and if that's the case, why, and is there anything we can do about it?
Well, thanks for that question. Yes, I mean, it depends. The answer to that question is a little bit complex in terms of, you know, our air pollution. On a day like today, you know, we're in an area where it's not bad like today. So we're in, you know, in April. When the wind blows, the dust blows, lofts in the air, then the air pollution becomes really bad. You know, we can exceed the air quality standards, the daily standards. And then the next day is clear, sunny, blue sky, and it's good. That's the particulate pollution. And then during the warm seasons, starting right about now, ozone starts to pop up, and that's basically from mobile sources, vehicles, as well as some industry drifting over from El Paso, Ciudad Juarez, and that starts to pop up. And that's sort of a That one we don't have a whole lot of control over, because it's not only what happens in Las Cruces, if you're calling for Las Cruces, but it's regionally in the what they call the Paso del Norte Air Basin, which is Ciudad Juarez, El Paso, Las Cruces, and a lot of that kind of drifts around. And it's sort of, you know, we're in the same air basin, so we kind of breathe the air that is we also get the air from, you know, a more populated industrial area like El Paso. So there's that two different types of air quality that we get impacted. And occasionally we get smoke from wildfires, you know, during the spring and summer and late summer, we get drifting smoke from we get it from like Canada and in Pacific Northwest. And we get the high pressure moves it clockwise and brings in all the way from, you know, hundreds of or thousands of miles actually. So that, and we share that with other states as well. So, but you know, it's kind of the episodic bad air quality. It's not all bad, but it's sort of on, at times it can be very bad.
Okay, and so it sounds like it's the times when it's really bad are usually or often associated with the wind, the dusty, and then the that's the particulate, and then also when it's warmer, that's why we see the haze, and I mean it just feels bad, and that's in the warmer months, the summer. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's more episodic in particulate matter. And one of them we care about is PM 2.5. And that's just the particulate goes far in our lungs, and it can trigger things like emphysema and all kind of other respiratory problems. And especially if you're, you know, dust storms, you know, if it's forecasted dusting, stay inside. That's probably one of the best things to do instead of going outside, you know, maybe delay it a day until usually dust storms are only last a few hours, maybe a day. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of adjusting your schedule.
Okay. And that is usually with the dust storms and the that particular PM 2.5, you said. That's
yes.
usually with associated with particulate pollution
yes.
and the dust storms.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
Wonderful. Thank you for clarifying.
Thanks for calling.
While I think of it, Kokoroz, we talked about what that is and how people can check the precipitation and tell you and, you know, see online. If somebody wants to do that or wants to just go online and see what the precipitation was in Hatch or wherever, what's the URL? Or?
Yeah, so we have a wonderful website, and it's Kokoroz is we're striving to be a North American program. So we've got folks in Canada, all 50 states, as well as in the Caribbean. And so it's a nice program, and so we have a great website, and the website is kokoroz.org, and it's spelled kokoroz.org, and it's everything you need to know. There's a map.
Spell it one more time,
okay.
Slowly.
Okay.
It's radio.
Yeah, it's kokoroz.org. And on the top right is you can learn how to join, and then before you join, maybe it's good to kind of browse the website. And you know, basically all it requires is if you buy a little 4-inch gauge, it's a standard gauge that we use all through Kokoroz. We don't accept any other brand or type. We have to use the same gauge because we measure the same thing across all of our. You know, we've got like 20,000 people contributing. And then there's online training, and then all you have to have is either a smartphone or a computer at home to enter the data.
Yeah.
And it's super simple. I do it on my smartphone. I'm like right up my gauge and fire up my old phone and enter my zero in, because usually it's zeros here in Las Cruces.
So you're not doing temperatures, you're just doing precipitation.
Just precipitation. Right. That's rain, hail, and snow.
Yeah. That's fun. Want to ask you about this. As I understand things, not being a scientist, we are basically in a situation where, based on what human beings have done to our environment, down the road things are going to get unpleasant. We don't know exactly how unpleasant. I think probably a lot of our people will be trying to get into Canada to get away down the road. But if you were a dictator, If we appointed you as
it's a
king,
strange premise.
instead of our current king, what ought we to be doing? You know, don't get into detail on each point, but to mitigate, what's the best we could do? What are the five or six things that is government or private enterprise or whomever, because you're the dictator, should do next?
Well, that's a tall order.
Yeah.
I never thought of myself as a dictator.
I mean, if we were appointing a dictator, you'd be on
maybe,
my short list.
Yeah, and get a pay raise, right?
Yeah. Dictators get paid well, I hear.
Well, anyway, I mean, I think incorporating, you know, in terms of where the problems are, you know, both, you know, the caller brought up two good points in terms of air pollution as well as the greenhouse gases for climate change. I know those are two, you know, that I could contribute to in terms of, you know, I know what kind of the knobs to turn that to kind of help things in a better way in terms of making the air cleaner to breathe and, you know, reduce, you know, respiratory problems across the world, and a lot of the programs that were in place actually were working, you know, in terms of the EPA, you know, regardless if you like them or not. But there is a lot of people contribute. It's not just a rogue agency or anything like that. So there's a lot of thought that went into, you know, how to mitigate air pollution. And I teach a course in that over at NMSU, and we go through the process. So why do we need to do this? You know, there's a good reason, because, you know, we get – you know, for instance, one of the examples I teach on is, there's a husband and wife who were farmers in the Southeast, and they were picking tobacco. And then behind the tractor, they were, you know, cutting the tobacco. And then the wife was sitting in the back, and she was starting to feel lightheaded, and she was almost ready to pass out. Basically, and it was the carbon monoxide from the tractor.
Sure.
It was going right into her breathing zone, and she ended up, you know, going to the hospital. And it was that's sort of something that we should have something to protect people in terms of so maybe there's a design, or how do we mitigate that? You know, and if she kept doing, she could have died. You know, and that's just one example out of millions that, you know, in terms of how do we, you know, how does it affect our everyday life? You know, maybe you're not a farmer, you know, mm-hmm. you're not impacted by carbon mm-hmm. monoxide, but there's programs now on how to control that, you know, and having the design as well as the fuel mixtures and things like that, and actually identifying the symptoms so that when you go to the hospital, they know what's going on.
Right. And I, you know, I think long term, clearly what it's going to do is going to increase migration. You're going to have more areas of the planet that are just uninhabitable, and that will, you know, certainly stir up all of the controversy around immigration and everything else that goes with it. So, you know, I think we can kind of see what's coming.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's many things that, you know, we put together in terms of, you know, we've studied it quite a bit, so we kind of know what to do now.
But
yeah.
What are some of the, you know, actual steps we ought to be taking?
Well, I mean, migrating, you know, because we have a finite amount of fossil fuels, and it's, you know, it's very hard to transition out of something you're used to, you know,
mm-hmm.
having, you know, semi trucks and diesel generators and, you know, our trains and boats, everything, airplanes, you know. There's a lot of, you know, movement towards, you know, changing that over time. It's going to, you know, take decades because, I mean, it takes a while to do a large change in how we do things. So, like, going from gasoline to electric, you know, for instance, like that. So how do we do that? You know, and that's, you know, we're slowly doing that.
Yeah,
you know,
well, I think clearly there needs to be a lot more investment in the infrastructure for electric vehicles.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's not just for personal vehicles. It's for, you know,
yes,
industry,
yes.
You know, having to, you know, it's not just the government clamping down. It's like, okay, how can we make an economic base on this industry? You know, and I think, you know, people to make money, you know, people like Musk, you know, not just picking on him, but it's more of that kind of person to kind of really be an entrepreneur and make money and actually, you know, be a leader in that area. And I think I encourage that kind of thing. I think it's good. I think, you know, being a leader in technology mm-hmm. and other areas I think is movement.
It's 9:30, so I want to remind folks that this is Speak Up Las Cruces, and you can speak up by calling us. The co-hosts are Walt Rubel and Peter Goodman, and our guest at this time is Dave Dubois. If you were tuned in looking for Michaela Lara Cadena, we have decided that we had erred in not having her challenger for State House District 33, Ramona Martinez. We screwed up and didn't invite her, so we've decided to cancel or postpone talking with Michaela until we can talk with Ramona as well, and they can talk with each other, that sort of thing, like we usually do. And we are going to be doing a lot of candidate fora over the next few weeks. We're going to continue talking with Dave
and
about
climate. And we
appreciate
Dave hanging in with us for another
And we're
hour.
Also, I think Heath Hausman, who's a local reporter, will join us about 9:40. One of the topics that I want to ask Dave about and want to talk with Heath about is the Project Jupiter and its effects on climate and effects on pollution, that sort of thing. So we will have Heath joining us by phone in about 10 minutes. Meanwhile, one of the things people are probably reading about, I mean, Walt and I did, is we're expecting an extra big El Nino, right?
Yes.
What's that going to mean?
Well, so El Niños are one of the phases of the El Niño Southern Oscillation, and that's mainly how we define that. There's three different phases. There's El Niño, La Niña, and neutral. And so that is primarily defined by the sea surface temperatures across the equatorial Pacific. So that's if you go along the equator from Papua New Guinea all the way to Ecuador, and it's a little slice of the ocean, and it goes down. It's basically sea surface temperatures. We're looking at if it's cooler than average, then it's a La Niña. If it's warmer than average sea surface temperatures, it's an El Niño. And then if it's right around average, that's the neutral zone. Mm-hmm. So we've, in the last looking at it over the last 20 years, we've had all three. However, in terms of the probabilities of a La Nina, we've actually had more cooler than average sea surface temperatures over the last 20 years. And that's kind of tipped our scale in terms of drought. So we're really happy to have an El Nino, that's the boy, which is a warmer than average sea surface temperature. And that typically for New Mexico, specifically just New Mexico, it's usually a cooler and wetter winter time. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of predictability in terms of summertime monsoons, although there's been some statistics, but it's more of there's not a clear physical connection in looking at jet streams and storm tracks and things like that. So El Ninos are good, and they develop in the summertime. They kind of peak in the summer, and then the impacts of El Ninos are typically in the wintertime, so which is really good for us because we have a really dismal winter snowpack right now, and we desperately need snow right now. But we have to wait until October comes around when it gets cool and the snow falls. So that's one thing that that's one of our good news that we're talking about in this this discussion is the hopes of having a probability of a cool and wet winter.
I remember the last time we had you on, it had been raining, for several days, and I said, hey, isn't that going to help? And your answer is, nah, it's all about the snowpack.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, our surface waters that we irrigate our agriculture, that's pretty much all snowpack. It does help a little bit when we have storms, but it's like, and it's mainly Colorado. It's like right around 70% approximately is in Colorado where we get our water from in terms of snow. And the rest is from New Mexico, Sangre de Cristos, Tusas, Chama, that area, mountains. And then we augment with rain, specifically for the Rio Grande Basin.
Right.
Other basins, the smaller reservoirs like the Pecos and Canadian, they actually can respond really well with rainfall. If they get a really good banners monsoon, they can maybe not fill the reservoirs,
right,
but they can actually get some good runoff that actually goes all the way down to Sumner, which is down by Carlsbad. Whereas Elephant Butte, that's a tough one because that's a big reservoir and there's a lot more users in two countries, two states. So that's a really tough one for us.
Yeah, we get enough rain to flood Votto is what we get.
Right.
So does it tell us anything about the heat wave that we can expect in the summer? Does it impact that at all?
Well, the official outlook from the Climate Prediction Center is warmer than average monsoon time. That's the summer, June, July, August.
Right.
That's kind of when the monsoon kicks in. And
used to be, anyway.
Yeah,
used
right,
to be.
Exactly.
That's right.
Well, and then the precipitation, it looked like it was, had some probabilities above average, some decent probabilities above average precipitation, starting in the southwest part of the state, in southeast Arizona. That's kind of the typical monsoon, moving into from Sonora into Chihuahua, and then kind of depending on where the large-scale high-pressure system sits, it can go either Dallas, Arizona, or New Mexico, depending on where the high is. That seems to be a good signal too. The monsoon. It's at least so far looking at maybe an average. I think that would be great because there's a lot of places in the last few years have missed out on the monsoon. Last year we had East Central New Mexico getting well above average precip, but there's some areas on the west side of the state really missed out on a lot of rain. It was in spots. It wasn't a good douse for the whole state. It was just kind of here and there. And then the northwest missed out a lot as well. They're still struggling.
Right.
Want to ask an offbeat question. You focus on a pretty grim subject, but you're an exceptionally cheerful person. How do you manage?
Well, I don't want to get down because of all these negative things, because you could be really depressed if you look at it. Because, even this week I sat in on a webinar. It was mainly it was very technical. It was a professor who's very well known in Columbia University, and he was basically showing that, you know, the CMIP-6, outlooks for the future, you know, going all the way out to 2040. And bottom line on that whole hour presentation, we're stuck in drought. There's mm-hmm. there's no cycles. There's nothing in any of the signals. And we're basically, it's just going to get worse. You know, if you're in drought now and been in it, like we've been in it since 1999, mega drought, we're in it for, you know, it's at least through 2040, you know, from that research. So, you know, I think my outlook is mainly, you know, so how do we actually work with each other? You know, how do we communicate? You know, that's the first thing, is communicating it out there, and then trying to get, you know, to get folks to understand what's going on, you know, and not to be a Dr. Doom, you
yeah.
know,
mm-hmm.
you know, it can easily turn into that. And I've been in that position where I've painted just a bad picture, and it's sort of, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done. Should have.
Yeah,
it's all about communicating.
Hopeless, then
yeah,
people,
it's. I don't want to paint a hopeless picture.
Right.
It's sort of okay. Here's the outlook, and so how do we actually, meet that? How do we actually still kind of adapt to that and still kind of, be managing that? You know, and I think even when I talk to ranchers in areas where they've had to sell like half their cattle inventory because of drought,
yeah,
long term, it's sort of, you know, so, you know, think about family, you know, the culture, you know, the other things that go on. And okay, so yeah, we're going to have to reduce and maybe even have to sell all the cattle eventually.
Right.
But so what do you have, you know, family, you know, maybe there's other things that can be done, you know, in terms of other jobs and things like that, and still be productive and have a, you know, it's sort of, you don't focus on all the negatives.
Yeah, right.
You know, there's always positives.
So having said that, could I just bring you right down and ask the biggest bummer?
Slap me down.
Yeah. We have, under this administration, we've pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. We have discontinued all kinds of research projects. We have ended all kinds of clean energy projects on the basis that windmills cause cancer and kill birds. I have no doubt that we will have another Democratic president who will come in and restore all of those things. But how much is this going to set us back? How much damage is being done?
Yeah, yeah, I know. You're right in terms of we can't. It's really, really hard to bounce back to what it was, you know, several years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. But it's more of, I talked to a lot of my climate community, you know, other state climate offices, and, you know, we're going to keep plugging what we do.
Yeah.
And regardless, I mean, yeah, our funding may be cut. We may have to reduce our staff and, you know, in certain cases, not here in New Mexico right now, you know, we're doing okay. But so how do we build what we got and be strong and, you know, kind of, you know, maybe there's alternatives, funding that we can go and, you know, it depends on your, you know, if you're a state employee or, you know, working at a company, you know, there's other options to kind of do the same thing, but just do it under a different name or a different way. And, you know, not to give up. I think that's the worst thing to do.
Of course.
We're talking, of course, with state climatologist Dave Dubois, and we want to bring in local reporter Heath Hauseman as well, who's on the phone. We'll talk a bit about a local climate change and pollution issue, Project Jupiter, and some of Heath's recent reporting on that, and then get a sense from both Heath and Dave, what's this all mean. Welcome, Heath.
Hey, thanks for having me on. And I've been listening to your conversation. I just want to say hi to Dave. And just so folks know, my wife and I own a few acres of land up in adjacent to the Gila National Forest in Sierra County. And we have a ZMET weather station from the network that Dave's office runs on our land. And that we gave them permission to put there. And it's... With federal cuts and other things, it's really great that New Mexico has such a strong network of weather stations of its own across the state, and I'm just Hi, Dave. It's really cool to be on the radio with you.
Thanks.
Well, I think it's cool to be on the radio with both of you.
Yeah.
For people who don't know, Heath, not going to get into his biography, but 15 years ago or more, Heath was doing a local reporting kind of thing, and then he got, where you subscribed or whatever and got the news from him, did a lot of good local reporting, and then he stopped doing that, and actually he was going to sell the business. I even talked to him about maybe buying it, but then he got back into it recently, and I'll let him start off by telling you his website and how you would subscribe, or you don't have to subscribe to get to read it, but if you can contribute, that helps. But what's your website, Heath?
Sure. It's radio is the hardest to communicate. This is, I use my last name, but it's Hausemann.com, H-A-U-S-S, and then it ends with Amen, A-M-E-N.com. Or you can look me up on Facebook or any of the other social media sites and find a link to it there. I'm back doing journalism and glad to be doing it.
And we're glad you're doing it. And one of the issues that you've been a leader in the reportage on is the county commission's approval of Project Jupiter down in Santa Teresa. And most recently, I think correct me if I'm wrong, but a fair summary would be they approved it back in September. A lot of people strongly opposed it for environmental and other reasons, but the people behind it had a lot of money, and a majority of the county commission thought, wow. And one of the concerns was water. Another was gas-fired turbines screwing up the air. And what's the most recent development in terms of water use?
Well, I think we are in the process of hopefully learning. I don't think we have, I'm certain we don't have all the facts yet, but the Santa Fe New Mexican reported early last week, quoting the general counsel in the state engineer's office, that Project Jupiter was actually going to use 1 million gallons of water a day, most of it for its natural gas turbines, which was news to all of us, including the county commission. Project Jupiter to that point had been very clear in their language, and actually their website still says this to this day, that they would be, their operational use is limited to 20,000 gallons a day on average that they would get through the Karua water system. We knew that they were separately running a line over from a sod farm that has water rights. It's not too far from where Project Jupiter is being built, but they had said publicly and elsewhere to county commissioners that that was a temporary line for construction. They would use it to fill up the closed-loop cooling system for the data centers. And it was county commissioners' understanding, and it was my understanding that that would be it. What's new then, and I followed up the Santa Fe New Mexican report, and I don't know that it's 1 million gallons of water a day. In fact, when I asked the state engineer for more details, they added some texture to that statement by saying that that number came from an informal conversation between the state engineer's general counsel and an attorney for Project Jupiter. And if I wanted to confirm it, I'd have to talk to Doniana County or Project Jupiter, which Doniana County knew nothing about it. And Project Jupiter is not answering the question. They're not confirming that number. They're not denying that number. But they did confirm that they're going to use the water from the sod farm in their microgrids, which is news. And that was news to the county commission, and they responded pretty forcefully. So yesterday they passed a resolution essentially directing staff to go on a fact-finding mission and investigate the situation and try to figure out what the actual number is, what's happening, what's changed from what they believed were their legal agreements, figure out if they think that's in compliance with the legal agreements, figure out if there are any points of negotiation where they can try to make this deal better or less bad than whatever it is now. So that's where we are.
Now, a sort of sub-issue there is what water is, I guess, in the sense that I think correct me if I'm wrong, but is the water coming from the hog farm non-potable?
It is, and there's a legal difference there that mostly my understanding is has to do with how deep the well is drilled and some of the technical specifications. Yeah. But it's also still water that comes out of the same water table as the drinking water.
Right.
A rancher, for example, or a farmer could have two wells, and one's potable and one's non-potable, and one goes to their house and they drink out of it, and one they irrigate their fields, but it's the same water table. So when we're dealing with water scarcity, I mean, what I've heard from the county commissioners unanimously is this is a huge concern, and that this is not what they intended when they agreed to these tax breaks last fall.
I want to ask Dave in a moment about the climate change or global warming or long-term weather implications of this. But when you look at the county commission, it seems as if they really were asleep at the switch when they signed on for this thing, or dazzled by the great amount of money, and they are now trying to do the right thing. But what would you say in terms of that? Are they belatedly trying to do the right thing? Or do you know?
That's a good question. I have been super critical of their process. I do think there are Open Meetings Act violations there that remain unresolved.
Indeed.
I do not like that on the day they voted, which I think was September 19th, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but these agreements were in the several hundred pages, 300 or 400. And they authorized the commission chairman at the time, who was Christopher Shelger Hernandez, to execute the final versions essentially behind closed doors on behalf of the commission. And they grew, I think, to more than 1,500 pages. And the word potable was added. Behind closed doors, there was no public policy discussion in public on why that word was added. So the agreement, when they voted, limited Project Jupiter's operational water use to 20,000 gallons a day on average and 60,000 max a day at peak use on the hottest day or whatever it would be. And by the time it was signed and we learned about that 11 weeks later, it only limited potable water to 20,000 gallons average a day. So there was, the Open Meetings Act should have required them to discuss that in public, and that didn't happen for that change. And so, but I do think it was my sense throughout the process, and I pushed hard on the water, frankly, much harder than on the air quality. There was so much happening. I made a list of, I'm going to start with transparency and process so the public could be involved. Then I'm going to get to water. Then I'm going to get to air quality, and the transparency and process stuff was so bad, I never got to the air quality. But it was my sense that they tried hard to get the water provision right, and that they really did value limiting the water. I think you're seeing that now in how unified they are in being concerned about this shift. I'm not saying they succeeded in getting the water right, but I know from a public relations standpoint, and I think from a practical standpoint, in an area that deals with so many concerns about water scarcity, the one thing that set Project Jupiter apart from so many of these other data centers was the promise of low water use. And so if there's a really big loophole and 1 million gallons a day or whatever it's going to be getting piped in from another source, and it's not actually low water use, the main thing that let them say we got a better deal than a lot of other communities may not actually exist.
I want to bring Dave back into the discussion. We non-scientists are all shouting about the water use and the contribution to greenhouse gases and that kind of thing. From your point of view as a state climatologist, how does Project Jupiter look to you?
Well, just looking at the numbers, and I think there's still, it's still in permit stage in terms of the impacts to both climate and air quality. I think I just kind of looked at your article, Heath. You had a number of 3 million automobiles equivalent for the CO2 amounts, and it just paints a really bad picture for all of our work to reduce greenhouse gases.
Just to be clear, 3 million a day would be what is the comparison there?
Yeah, it's just the same amount of carbon dioxide produced by this, the proposed data center would be equivalent to about 3 million automobiles. I would have to verify that how that would go, but it's But that sounds about right in
terms
of CO2.
More automobiles than driving around
CO2.
The next
No, that's something that people can understand.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
So it's that issue, you know, because of the governor's, you know, task force, the Climate Change Bureau, and I recently met with the bureau chief. They came to Las Cruces and we talked about clean transportation, so which is great, you know. I think, but then we got this big elephant in the room, you know this is going to come, but then you know we're down in the smaller nickel and diming, you know, and you know it's tough to kind of do these programs when we have big things like this coming in that's going to cancel, you know, in terms of the greenhouse gases, the total footprint of it, you know, and that's not even talking about the air quality part, which is, you know, we have issues with, like I mentioned, that the caller talked about, it brought up air quality, ozone, you know, and then the emissions from the natural gas turbines they're a cleaner technology than coal, but they're still burning natural gas, right. And NOx, NO2, is the primary precursor for ozone. That's going to affect our regional ozone, and we're already, you know, we've had some decreases in our ozone, you know, over the area, but it's still not, we're not out of the clear in terms of, you know, a big source like this, you know, the microgrids, which are basically power plants, another word for those, you know, that I don't really know the impact, because it's very difficult to actually estimate that without knowing the, like, modeling. We need to have detailed modeling on how it in fact impacts Mexico, El Paso, and Las Cruces, and the region, you know, because it's a significant amount of NOx that is being emitted, that could be emitted.
Heath, I'm curious, do you know the water rights that are being taken for this? Was that water being used before, or would this be additional water being taken out of the...
I say it's a sod farmer or a grass farmer, because that's what the guy was doing with his water rights. And I don't think they were completely being wasted. This is anecdotal, but what I've been told is that he was watering sod so that he could keep his water rights. But then there are area parks in cities like Las Cruces. When the city would need a replacement, they could buy from him.
Right.
And I was even told that there's an NFL team that needed sod on an emergency basis somewhere in the West that got trucked in from here. So I think, he was using some of it. But from what I'm told, and I talked to the owner of the company that owns a sod farm, and he refused to talk to me and acknowledged that he had signed an NDA with the companies. Right. So I don't have this verified, but my understanding is that he was mostly using his water so that he wouldn't lose the water rights.
Okay.
Project Jupiter is very quick to say our use is going to be lower than their historic use of the sod farm. So we're not increasing water use. And actually, if you compare it to historic use of these water rights, it'll be lower.
One of the scariest parts of all that is, I think you said they changed in the language of the contract, changed water to potable water at some point in the dark.
Yes, you did. You did understand.
That's going to play a big role in what we've been concerned about.
Let me just make clear, too, from what I understand, they haven't purchased, Project Jupiter's not purchased water rights, which would be a transaction that would go before the state engineer's office. They're just buying water from the rights holder.
That's important, And I guess my bigger question, we're running out of time, but Dave, let's say all that goes through, and this is in an area that already has had issues with arsenic in the water. What danger is there of getting to the place where drinking water may not be available in that region?
There's a lot of unknowns, and I was even thinking about, okay, well, this also signals other data centers could come. If this gets approved, and you know, it's okay. Well, this is and that's other places around the country are seeing that. You know, there's clusters of data centers. You know, we got one in El Paso.
Once you open the door,
scary.
And go ahead. If I could just add to that, I think look for some reporting from me on this in the future. But I think there's a real tension here between the state's efforts over four decades to grow an industrial economy in this area, to reduce our dependence on the oil and gas industry, which is partly about climate change, right? But here we are with that goal, as we're finally maybe on the cusp of realizing the growth here, that now there's real questions because climate change has advanced so much, and we have surface and groundwater issues that are very real, that these two things may be crashing into each other. And I have some real questions about, are we going to be able to realize the goals that we've spent untold billions of dollars on over years?
We're out of time, and I want to do two things very quickly. One is, Heath, tell folks again how they get to your newsletter.
Sure. It's Hausamen.com, Hausamen.com.
And Dave, am I correct that the celebration of Earth Day is going to be starting at 3 p.m. with a bunch of booths and then later music at Young Park?
Yes, Young Park, 3 p.m., April 18th.